From Inside Higher Ed, this is This Week at Inside Higher Ed, the informed and essential conversation about the week's news in higher education. This Week is made possible through the generous support of our sponsors, ACT, Barnes & Noble College, Intel Corporation, Lumina Foundation, Oracle, and 2U.
Greetings from This Week at Inside Higher Ed. Starbucks, in partnership with Arizona State University, launches a new initiative to help baristas get baccalaureate degrees. And a new book argues that the open-door policy of most community colleges does a disservice to students who are not prepared for college, leaving them, quote, with failing grades, a damning transcript, and potentially significant debt, end quote. Hi, this is Casey Green, the moderator for This Week at Inside Higher Ed, where we go behind and beyond the news to provide the informative and engaging conversation about what really matters in higher education. Our program today has two topics. We'll begin the conversation with Michael Crow, the president of Arizona State University, to talk about the Starbucks Baccalaureate Initiative. He will be joined by Robert Kelchin, assistant professor of higher education at Seton Hall University, and Scott Jasek, an editor at Inside Higher Ed. The second topic will focus on access issues in community colleges. I'll be talking with Mira Anson and Julia Cheer, authors of a new book, Community Colleges and the Access Effect. Scott Jasek will also participate in the second conversation as well. So we welcome you and remind you that you can post comments to the conversations we're having today online at insidehighered.com/thisweek. Let's turn to baccalaureates for baristas. Starbucks, in partnership with Arizona State University, earlier this week announced a major initiative to help employees earn bachelor's degrees. The company will provide tuition assistance to bridge the gap between student aid and the cost of an online degree program at Arizona State University for baristas who have already completed two or more years of college. Employees who have no or few college credits are also eligible to participate in the program, but the tuition benefits are not as significant. Interestingly, there are no strings attached in that Starbucks is not dictating which major students should pursue, and students who receive support from Starbucks are not obligated to work for the company once they've completed their baccalaureate degrees. Michael Crow, this is a big deal. It got lots of publicity earlier this week, headlines not just at Inside Higher Ed, but the New York Times not only had a story, but several columns about it. What's to like about this initiative?
I think, thanks, Casey. I think from our perspective, what's important about this initiative is college completion. So why is it that so many individuals who start college don't graduate and then ultimately never graduate, never complete either their associate's degree or their bachelor's degree? This is about college completion, a university with a very sophisticated technological platform coming together with a corporation wherein this focus on the individual human capital objective of enhancing learning is empowered by us eliminating for the last 2 years of college education all financial barriers while you're working to advance your personal life or your family. So for us, it's an unbelievable opportunity to prove the point that there is a method to enhance an employee's opportunity to complete their college degree if they never had a chance to complete it.
Robert Kelchin, there's kind of a morning after effect in a lot of the conversation that's unfolded following the announcement earlier this week. Again, lots of publicity and a lot of very positive comments early on about the Starbucks ASU initiative, but academics, as they are wont to do, begin to pick at the details and the devil in the details. And let's talk about some of the picking, if you will. You had written about this at Inside Higher Ed earlier this week.
Yes, and thank you for having me on. So I think the biggest concern that I have is I don't think as many students will benefit as the public may think, because of the restrictions that are on the program. So, for example, it does have to be, or in order to get full reimbursement, students have to be at the junior and senior level. And while Arizona State does not get credit in federal metrics for actually graduating these students, they do get a lot of good publicity, and they're doing a valuable service. But it's just worth noting that Starbucks particularly is not putting in as much money as people might think. Arizona State puts in more money through tuition discounting than Starbucks will for a fair number of students.
Michael Crow, is that a fair assessment, that actually more will come from ASU as opposed to Starbucks? That's not what the headlines and sort of the public conversation would initially suggest.
These programs are complex, and so let me tell you exactly how it works. So because of our relationship with Starbucks, because of the fact that the students are not sought but are, in a sense, already a part of a program, because they're already inside a corporation with a structure to communicate with them and so forth and so on, we were able to construct a cost structure for the program, which is enabling us to deliver the program wherein our need-based financial aid, a base-level scholarship, federal Pell Grants for those students that are eligible, plus the corporation's investment, is enough to get the student through without any personal expenditure for their tuition, and at the same time pay for the program itself. And so this is what I said at the outset. This is a construct that, because of our relationship with Starbucks and their relationship with us, each leveraging both organizations in every possible way, we're able to do something which is quite exciting for the individual student, and that is give them an opportunity to complete their college education at no additional cost for the tuition. And I think that what's important about this is that it's really, in this case, about the student. It's the student having this opportunity while working to finish their degree with no cost to the tuition. And it's only because of the relationship between Starbucks and ASU that we can put this entire package together.
Now, Jacek, there's some criticism that in one sense ASU and Starbucks are pre-selecting winners, in the sense that the major benefits of this program go to Starbucks employees who've already completed 2 years of college, as if they were, you know, transferring out of a community college, if you will, or have the equivalent kinds of credits. So they've, if you will, overcome some of the most difficult hurdles of the first 2 years of college. Is that a fair criticism?
Well, I actually think that along those lines, the important criticism is that you have to take 21 credits before you get reimbursed. That basically means that you're talking about students who not only have they completed freshman and sophomore years, but they have the means to upfront pay that money. The impression a lot of people got from the initial announcement was, we're making it possible for people without resources to go forward. What the program does, if I'm understanding correctly, is it reimburses students who have their own means to do this. Now, look, Starbucks doesn't have to do this. Arizona State doesn't have to do this. There are definitely students who will benefit. But in a lot of the commentary suggested there are many who might benefit for whom, say, $10,000 out-of-pocket expenses will be a deal-breaker.
Yeah, it is quite significant that it is this chunk of 21 courses before reimbursement, as opposed to kind of a reimbursement as you go. Michael Crow?
Yeah, I can comment on that. So, Scott, I think, you know, you're right at the numbers in that sense. It was a conscious decision on our part with Starbucks to enhance the probability of success by creating an opportunity for the student to have an incentive to complete. And so one of the things that we're after is that the student, in all likelihood, will borrow the money on a short-term basis to pay the tuition, and then upon completion, will have that that personal expenditure paid back. Now, that's a theory on our part, that what we're after is a very high completion rate. In our present online programs, which are very sophisticated, the most sophisticated learning platforms, I think, that are out there, we have 40 degrees. We've got about 10,000 degree seekers right now with a higher than a 90% retention rate semester to semester. These are all, 99% of them are degree completers. And you're right, that is easier than starting with students coming right out of high school, which this might not be the best program for. But having said that, our focus on this program is, can we have a 85% or 90% graduation rate? No one has ever accomplished anything like that anywhere. No university, no corporation, no one. And so for us, what we've done is we've made a number of decisions that allow us to think, how can we incentivize, how can we create a financial structure which leads to an actual outcome? You know better than most people that right now we have massive amounts of expenditures by lots of groups, but no graduation. What we're focused on is graduation. So we have an incentive structure, we have an organizational structure, we have a learning structure, we have a technology structure, we have a relationship, we have a communications plan. We think this can lead to enhanced college completion. We have more people that went to college and didn't graduate college, including community colleges, without degrees than we do with degrees. And so it's a huge problem that we have to solve, and that's what we're trying to do.
Robert Kelchin, one of the other criticisms of the program is this notion of forced choice, both ASU and particularly the ASU online program. While, you know, as Michael Crow says ASU has remarkably high numbers in terms of retention and persistence for its online program. Some observers say that still it's online. Online is not necessarily a great fit for many learners. Is that a fair critique as well?
I'd say it's a fair critique that online isn't the best for everyone. Some people prefer to go to in-person classes, and there's nothing stopping them from doing that. They just don't get the funding from Starbucks. Now, what's also worth noting here is that many of these students can take federal, state, or institutional financial aid dollars and get a degree elsewhere for a similar cost, say if they go to their local state university. And that just goes back to the cost structure of this, that Starbucks, for many low-income students, doesn't have to contribute more than a few hundred dollars a semester, where the institution and the federal government are taking care of that.
But Michael Crow, isn't it the case that this program essentially has ASU and Starbucks filling that bridge between whatever federal aid might cover and the actual costs of the program?
Yes, absolutely. So again, our objective is college completion, and so what we're doing, if there's something going on here, we're happy to, when we've been in this program a couple of years, to be sort of put out there. Well, here's our numbers. Here's how many started. Here's how many persisted. Here's how many graduated. And here are the measured learning outcomes of those individuals. And so we believe that our learning outcomes will be as good or better than any learning outcomes that anyone can get anywhere. And we're very confident with that, based on the graduates that our online programs are already producing. Let me say, just to put this into perspective, I was looking at some numbers last night. We've had 115,000 unique visitors to the ASU Starbucks College program website. Just looking at the website, we have 1,400 people in the queue right now for pre-admission advising. We have 1,500 formal applications already. I mean, these are huge numbers indicating that there's a lot of people that have an interest in completing their degree, and this is going to help them to be able to do that.
Michael Crow, in your comments earlier this week at the announcement that was held in New York, you talked about academics as being leery of corporate organizations that are profit-driven, and one of the things that made the Starbucks agreement very interesting was Starbucks is not entirely profit-driven. Howard Schultz, the CEO, talks about his own experience growing up in subsidized housing, that this is an attempt really to do good, not just to do well. And yet, again, many academics note that part of the agreement essentially channels folks into an agreement that you have with Pearson, which has a significant role in your online program, and they view, rightly or wrongly, Pearson as very profit-driven as opposed to people-driven. Is that a fair critique?
Yeah, I don't think it's a fair critique in the sense that, you know, what we've maintained control of is by our faculty, and our faculty are really immensely empowered and empowering behind this, is the content and the design of the pedagogy and the learning platforms and so forth. What we learned, and I learned this in some previous activities I was involved with, was that we don't want to have to deal with anything but what we know. What we know how to do is we know how to teach, we know how to build learning platforms, we know how to design pedagogy, we know how to incentivize students to be successful. What we did in our relationship with Pearson was find someone willing to take on all the other assignments for us that we didn't want to do. That's true in many things that the university does. We have 10,000 mediated courses on our university campus here in our immersion learning environment using Blackboard learning platforms. Blackboard's a company that we purchase services from and technology from and tools from. We have 100 other companies that we purchase services and tools from so that we can do our job better and more efficient and more effectively. So I don't have any concerns about the Pearson relationship. They enable us to do what we're trying to do, which is what we think is working to make this more effective than many other programs.
Scott, but you track a lot of this as well. Pearson has become kind of a flashpoint for many academics. Is the criticism fair or not?
Well, I mean, it's certainly true that there are academics who distrust any large company. It's also true that there are academics who use many of those same companies. Sort of just getting back to this program, I mean, some unique things that I think speak well of the program, if you go to the range of courses offered or of majors offered, you see things like business global logistics management that you could say fit in with a Starbucks need, but you also see art history and English. There's a commendable range of options here within ASU Online. Where I hear more of the criticism is Starbucks is putting all of its options in one form of higher education. No doubt it's a great option for some Starbucks employees, but with Starbucks holding this out as the national model, what other companies should do, I think that then begs the question, should all companies support but one model of education?
Well, let's move to that for a moment. Michael Crowe, is Starbucks throwing down the gauntlet to other firms to do something, anything?
Well, I mean, I think when Howard Schultz was asked that question a couple times, he said, listen, he doesn't run other corporations, but he does have a very strong view, and the corporation has a track record of leading innovation in terms of human capital investment for their employees, and this is yet another example of that. You know, I don't think that anyone is saying that this is the way, that the ASU Starbucks way is the way. What we view this as is it's a way to get started. It's a way to learn how to do this. You know, I can tell you from my perspective, I'm obsessed with one thing, college completion. We have 3 years ago, we could not have done this before we launched ASU Online, and we've been spending years and years and years building the platform. ASU Online has taught us, before we did the Starbucks initiative, who our students out there that are trying to complete their degrees are, and we've learned an immense amount of insight relative to their learning environment and their learning success potential from our experience up to this point. And so the program we have with Starbucks is geared around that. There might be 50 other ways to do this. This is the way that we're launching this to see how it works. And we hope that others will design their own initiatives to achieve the same goal, the goal being producing more high-quality college graduates while they are working adults and have moved on with their life, basically enhancing already, in a sense, catalyzed human capital and taking that and moving it to the next level at the fastest possible speed at the lowest possible cost.
So very quickly then, let's pursue that as the last question for this conversation. 2, 3, and 5 years from now, what will be the appropriate metrics for success? How will both ASU and Starbucks, as well as the rest of us from the outside, know that this program has been effective? Again, Michael Crowe, let's begin with you.
So 2 years from now, we'd be looking to have 10, 15, 20, 25,000 active students. 3 years from now, we'd be looking at measuring the learning outcomes of a few thousand graduates. And 5 years from now, we'd be looking to see if we're able to produce 3,000 or 4,000 graduates per year on a steady state basis whose learning outcomes can be measured and held up against the learning outcomes of any other college graduates. That is, they've got what it takes to move forward and so forth. That's our 2, 3, and 5 year outcomes.
Robert Kelchin, as an observer of this, as a scholar of higher education, what's your take on the 2, 3, and 5?
The initial goal should be looking at access. How many students are getting into this? And are these students whose likelihood of completion is 100%, or are these students whose likelihood is a little bit lower? I get a little bit concerned when the focus is on completion rates of 80-90%, when it could be better to have a 75% completion rate with 20,000 students than a 90% completion rate with 10,000 students. And I hope that Arizona State is using its sophisticated data systems to track where these students came from initially and try to get an idea of how they would have done had they attended another school and how many of them may have been drawn to attend Arizona State who would not have finished their degrees otherwise.
Scott Jasek, as a journalist who will continue to follow this story as it unfolds, not just at points of 2, 3, and 5, but over the coming months and the next 2, 3, and 5 years, again, what would constitute success?
Well, I'm very excited about getting the kinds of data that President Crowe talked about having in years 2, 3, and 5. And I think, following on what Robert just said, the who they are, who participates, who doesn't participate. You can find Starbucks in upscale and not so upscale parts of America. Do we see similar rates of participation? And also, I am curious, given the Starbucks challenge in this, does this prompt other models to come forward? If it does, that might be exciting even to those who question this particular model.
Great. My thanks to the three of you, Michael Crowe, president of Arizona State, Robert Kelchin at Seton Hall, and Scott Jasek, for the conversation today. Our second topic today will focus on a new book titled Community Colleges and the Access Effect by Julia Cheer and Mira Anson. Their book asks if it is time to reassess the open-door mission of community colleges. Juliet is a professor of English at St. Louis Community College, and Mira is the director of the Upward Bound program at the University of Iowa. Welcome both Juliet and Mira. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for having us, Casey.
By way of background information, the majority of undergraduates in the United States begin their college careers in community colleges. Yet reflecting the challenge and consequences of poor academic preparation, large numbers of entering students of all ages are directed into non-credit developmental education courses in math, reading, and writing, which are intended to improve their academic skills, often or in aggregate, with mixed results. The students who drop out often incur significant debt along the way. The question is, would admission standards requiring some basic level of academic skills better serve students, their institution, and the nation at large? Would students be better served if they had better counseling on the way in terms of choices at the community college? Let's also note that the issue of academic readiness for college-level work is not limited to community colleges. For example, each fall, some 60% of the entering freshmen at the 23 campuses of the California State University, entering freshmen who have been in the top third of their high school graduating classes in California to be CSU eligible, are assessed as needing developmental ed courses in math or other areas. So let me begin. Mira, what's the central thesis of the book? A quick summary for those who have not had a chance to read it.
Sure. The Access Effect is really about improving the culture of learning in America at all levels of education for all students. As you mentioned, there's been a dramatic shift in the preparation ability levels of entering community college students. In an attempt to serve these students, many institutions have responded with increasingly higher levels of developmental ed courses to address these basic skills. So couple student underpreparedness for traditional degree programs with the recent completion agenda movement, and community colleges seem to be facing a perfect storm of sorts. We argue for a more compassionate approach to advising students, and further establishing reasonable entrance standards for traditional degree programs, financial aid eligible programs. So we believe that this will accomplish a more genuine post-secondary student success and equity gains than policies focused solely on completion. And most importantly, this will do so without sacrificing academic standards.
Juliet, my guess is that this book has been a catalyst for lots of conversation on both sides of the issue. What are you hearing, and what's your response to what you're hearing, both pro and con, the top-level argument?
We have heard that it has generated some discussion. We have not read a lot of that just yet. The book is out, and it's early. We're first-time authors. We could not really predict whether or not our ideas would receive any attention, especially after we've struggled for years to get people in power to pay attention to some of the critical policy matters we take on in the book. But the positive feedback we've received in response has been truly overwhelming. Regardless, though, of where anyone stands on the issues we raise, we're simply grateful for the enthusiastic debate. We aren't at all surprised that some of the initial knee-jerk reactions to our title, we certainly understand the apprehension, but we do believe readers who approach our book with an open mind will find a thoughtful, nuanced discussion that upholds the tandem values of post-secondary education expansion and actually increased opportunity.
So let's go to the book. You make a very strong argument, and I'm quoting directly from the text. We simply enroll underprepared students first, charge them and taxpayers for semesters of courses, then straddle students with failing grades, a damning transcript, and potentially significant debt. How much more humane would it be from the beginning if we required students to demonstrate modest possession of basic skills before being allowed to enroll into financial aid eligible college experience and courses? That's not a modest statement. That's a very strong statement. Mira, want to build that out a little bit for us?
Sure. Well, we know that students who enroll beyond their immediate abilities often incur student debt they can't overcome. At the one higher education institution, they seek to make their lives better, to pursue some sort of post-secondary education. And so the consequence of that is often that alternative opportunities are often permanently severed. Juliet, do you have anything else to add to this response as well?
Sure. I would add that community colleges with very thin budgets are forced to take on that bad debt. Oftentimes, student credit ratings are impacted when they're unable to clear the debt with the college. It makes them ineligible for alternative programs such as workforce and job training that they might have really had a better opportunity to succeed in. There's just a lot of unseen strings attached to financial aid. And when students are prematurely qualified for that, it can really be damaging to them and their completion.
Scott, the book makes a well-documented argument, but it's not necessarily a new argument. We've heard parts of this from all, you know, various points across the spectrum for a long time. You know, as somebody who has watched this as a journalist for a number of years, what's your take on this issue and the presentation in the book?
Well, it's certainly true that the issue of remedial education and whether it is working for anyone has gotten a lot of attention in recent years, and many people, including some who are objecting strongly to this book, would agree that the remedial education system has been flawed. The issues that I'm seeing on our site raised by critics are, one, where will the students go? It's great to think about how those who wouldn't meet the admission standards might get good education and training elsewhere. I'm seeing many people say there isn't an alternative in place, sort of, you know, the first do no harm argument. The other point that I'm seeing made by a number of people is that, in fact, right now, remedial education is going through tremendous reforms at many community colleges. So the fact that it has not worked well doesn't mean the only choice is to preserve what had been the status quo. Can remediation be improved?
Let's talk about remediation for a moment. The book goes into a great deal of detail about remediation efforts. Tom Bailey and his colleagues at the Community College Research Center, a teacher's college at Columbia University, have offered some fairly compelling data suggesting that many students directed into developmental education courses don't need them and can succeed without them. That seems to run a bit counter to part of the argument that the two of you have offered. Juliet, what your response to the Bailey data?
Actually, we wholeheartedly agree with the CCRC findings. We regularly enroll in community colleges students who could succeed without developmental education in college-level courses. A lot of students are remanded to DevEd based on one high-stakes placement test, and the students taking those tests oftentimes don't understand the ramifications of their performance. So many false negatives do occur, and students are unfortunately misplaced in courses below their skill levels. That needs to be addressed. It must be addressed. Ironically, though, in an attempt to promote student success, many have been exempted from developmental education sequences, or that seems to be a trend. Some states have lowered cut scores and really fast-forwarded more at-risk students into unsupported college-level courses. So the alternative there that's being proposed is really dangerous for a lot of students.
I think part of the challenge in the conversation about this book is the anecdotal versus the aggregate. You know, there are, as you acknowledge in the book, many who work in developmental ed can cite the case of a particular student who has surpassed overwhelming odds in terms of their academic preparation and their life circumstances. On the other hand, you also cite some examples of those who experience overwhelming odds and leave, as you suggested, with a damning transcript and significant student debt. Where do we find the middle ground between the aggregate statistics and the anecdotal stories? Juliet?
I think it's important that, you know, that we push more resources, if you will, into advising, and that we have more honest debate and discussion about how we place students and how we guide them with enrollment. We presume a lot that students who knock on the community college door are wanting a traditional DevEd sequence into a college degree pathway. And I find a lot of students are actually there hoping for a fast track into employment, entry-level employment. They want some job training. They're not necessarily chasing a degree, but they find themselves directed into degree pathways. So I think a lot more comprehensive advising is warranted and discussion about what our community members are truly coming to the community college for.
Scott, let's go back to your point about reform in developmental education. Is it the case that, you know, where are the reforms focused? Is it on advising, as Mira and Juliet suggest? Is it on placement? Is it on better promotion that we have programs that are not just college track?
It's all of the above. I mean, part it's on sort of mandatory advising, saying we're not going to just let you decide. It's about things like, do you link a remedial course with a four-credit course at the same time? It's do you create learning communities? Do you divide DevEd into chunks so that the student who really only is missing one key skill can quickly work through that? Can you have smaller class sizes? Can you use adaptive learning? There's a ton going on right now. Now, the problem, of course, is that there are a lot of great experiments and there's a lot of reform ideas. I'm not sure you could make a case that to date there's been a single comprehensive plan that's being used nationwide.
And again, you know, a lot of these, though, seem to be site-specific. Do they scale? Mira, you've taken a long look at this. You know, at what point do initiatives at a particular community college or a model promoted, for example, and you cite this in the book, the efforts of the Gates and the Lumina Foundation, provide scalable interventions in the area of developmental ed to enable students to reach their goals?
Certainly, and we see there's a lot of excellent interventions that have been put into place that are scalable and that can be applied at a variety of institutions. The fact of the matter is, even the best interventions, however, still leave students behind. And this still does not account for students who are seeking a different pathway, for students who maybe that traditional degree program is not the best fit for their goals, their abilities, their interests. And so all the reforms are excellent, and the completion agenda and the foundations have done a great job at creating these initiatives to better improve students, but we're still not getting at the heart of the issue in terms of what is the best thing we can do to serve students and honor the diverse interests and abilities that our students bring.
Right. The book is quite candid and very clear that the most affected populations are obviously low-income students and disproportionately minority students. I'm mindful in the context of this conversation of the comment by George W. Bush as he promoted No Child Left Behind about the problem of the bigotry of low expectations. And I'm guessing that there will be those who criticize your work who directly or indirectly bring that back. Scott, let me ask you to sort of talk a little bit more about the criticism.
Sure. Well, I mean, the headline on a blog post about the book was Keep Out the Poor, the Huddled Masses. And I think that what that reflects is a concern that if you go to admission standards, the groups that are least likely to meet them in many communities will be your low-income minority students. Now, the argument in the book might well benefit those of all races and ethnic groups who get over whatever hurdles are put, but the question is, in our society, do we have a viable plan, say, to improve urban high schools? Do we have alternatives for the people who have had the worst experiences with the public education system to get the skills they need? And I sense a lot of worry about that, not just, you know, whenever people talk about admission standards at places that have been open admissions.
Mira, let me give you a chance to respond to that as well, to those who will criticize the book, again, sort of under the umbrella of not your intent, of course, but what others might have called the bigotry of low expectations, or the consequences of that.
Sure. Well, I think if we look at the numbers, certainly, of course, that is a valid criticism, and I think that's an important piece to hold into this conversation. And that's part of the reason why we had open access, in the first place, to open access to college enrollment for students from underrepresented populations. But what we see now, however, is there is this increasing tension between getting all students in and getting them through. At the same time, colleges, things such as the completion agenda, colleges are an increasing pressure to get students through and to graduate them. And so something's got to give at some point. At what point do we bring students in who are increasingly unprepared and colleges are increasingly expected by federal or state policies to graduate those students? And so at some point, we have to better serve these students. And the worst thing that can happen is that we bring these students into a degree program and soften the standards for them, that we soften the program just to get students through. And that's really what our book, we come back to what our book is really about, and that is improving our culture of learning in America and enhancing academic achievement at all levels.
I want to come back to Remedy. You take a great deal of time in the book, not just at the back end, but throughout the book, to talk about the need for better academic advising, better counseling, better opportunities to help students who obviously want some kind of post-secondary experience understand that college is not the only opportunity. And certainly community colleges have had a long history with lots of the kind of adult ed, vocational ed, short certification kinds of programs. how do we make that better? I mean, that seems to be the direction. It's not necessarily a new direction. You know, how do, in fact, community colleges do a better job at intake in terms of the advising function without making it seem like it's tracking students in an inappropriate way that brings back the activities of generations ago? Yeah, Julia, let me ask you to respond to that.
We like the Do No Harm clause, first of all. We're in favor of that, and to suggest that that our approach is increasing harm, I think, ignores the fact that allowing all students into a college degree path, it also causes harm to a lot of students that are unprepared. So a lot more intrusive advising, a lot more consideration of multiple measures. That all takes time and it takes money, frankly. So I think investment in our public education institutions, avoiding diversion of funds to alternatives outside the community college. Community colleges need to be financially supported, and we've received a great deal of money from the federal government recently for workforce training and job training. That's very important, and I think we need to also, look at state funding and reinvest money in our public education institutions, particularly the community college.
Scott, let me give you the opportunity for a last comment. This book's been out now since early April. It's gotten some play, obviously, at Inside Higher Ed and elsewhere. Is the work that Mira and Juliet have done, will it be a catalyst for the renewed conversation that they call for about the issues of access to community colleges?
I think the reality is their book is coming at a time that community colleges are more on the higher ed agenda than they have historically been. They've always been important, but for too long, I think policymakers have ignored them. If you look right now at the goals of the Obama administration, of many governors, of many foundations, about increasing the share of the U.S. population that has a degree, you can't achieve those goals unless more students succeed at community colleges. So while I'm not sure that everyone will embrace the ideas in the book, confronting these issues one way or another strikes me as very important right now.
Great. This has been a very engaging conversation. No doubt the conversation will continue. My thanks to Mira Anson and Julia Scheer for joining us today for a conversation about their new book, Community Colleges and the Access Effect. And that's it for our program today. My thanks to panel members in Segment 1, Michael Crow, Robert Kelchin, and Scott Jasek. And in our second conversation, Mira Anson, Juliet Scheer, and again, Scott Jasek. And our thanks to you, our audience, for joining us for this edition of This Week at Inside Higher Ed. This Week is posted as an audio streamer podcast early in the afternoon on most Fridays. On the web, we are available at insidehighered.com/thisweek. Please share your thoughts about the program on the comments section of the webpage. Thank you.
Join us for the next edition of This Week at Inside Higher Ed. Funding for This Week is provided by 2U, ACT, Barnes & Noble College, Intel Corporation, Lumina Foundation, and Oracle. This Week at Inside Higher Ed is a production of G2 Education. Executive producer is Ginny Goldstein. Technical support is provided by Learning Times.